I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, we look back at the life of Charles Darwin and why it took him so long to write about his theory of evolution. But first, why hasn't the $200 billion that the government gave to hundreds of the nation's banks increased lending as intended? Well, that's among the questions the Legislative Committee on Capitol Hill takes up today. And it comes on the heels of a Federal Reserve report which showed that lending to consumers and businesses has declined, especially at those banks that received government bailout money. One of the first bailout recipients, Citigroup, is outlining plans today to spend $36.5 billion to increase lending. And the Wall Street Journal reports that Citigroup may also back out of a $400 million marketing deal with the New York Mets, who currently play at Citi Field. Benjamin Applebaum is covering the story for the Washington Post. And Benjamin, you write that the $200 billion federal investment for banks to boost lending has not worked. Why not?
The essential reason is that the government didn't give it to the banks that were best equipped to increase lending. Instead, this round of investments has focused disproportionately on banks that needed help, that needed money to digest acquisitions or to solve their own problems. It has gone to a different set of banks than those you would have given it to if your goal was to increase lending.
So has it helped weak banks primarily then, would you say?
Yeah, I think that's a fair characterization. There was a real concern that we were going to see a wave of bank collapses this fall, and the priority was to stabilize these institutions. And so we gave $45 billion to Citigroup, a company that has been told to shrink itself. We gave money to help facilitate deals between troubled and healthier institutions, mergers to create healthier banks. We gave money for a lot of things, but it's not clear that that money is ever going to increase lending.
Did the fact that there was no massive shutdown in the banking industry, at least, is that a bright spot in all of this?
The officials who crafted this program do hold that up as their achievement. There's no question that the industry appears to have stabilized since its most troubled days this fall. There's no question that a lot of banks that needed money in order to survive have gotten it through this program. And are in better shape than they otherwise would have been. At the same time, what we found when we looked at it is that lending decreased in the fourth quarter, and that lending by institutions that got government money decreased even more substantially. Not because there's some type of causal link where if you get government money, you lend less, but precisely because these are weaker institutions that are getting the money.
You wrote about Eagle Bank in Bethesda, Maryland. How is that an example of what you're talking about?
This is an institution that had just acquired a troubled rival, another local bank called Fidelity and Trust, and they had planned to raise money from private investors to shore up their own financial situation in the wake of that acquisition. It's gotten a lot harder to raise money from private investors. For a bank, it's pretty nearly impossible right now. And so Eagle Bank had gone from being, you know, pretty healthy to having trouble on its balance sheet. The government money allowed them to get back to healthy. And left about half of the government invested about $38 million, and about half of that money was available to increase lending after they solidified their deal. The problem for Eagle Bank is that it doesn't have enough deposits to take advantage. The money that's actually lent to borrowers comes from deposits. It's a separate pot of money, and Eagle Bank doesn't have enough money in that pot to take advantage of its increased lending limit.
So basically, it's the deposits that are critical as well. Weren't deposits at the nation's banks in the last quarter up overall?
So this is really interesting. Absolutely. People have been pouring money into banks, fleeing from riskier investments. Deposits grew quite strongly at the nation's banks. But what's interesting is where those deposits went. And they went disproportionately to two kinds of institutions. The weakest institutions, which need the money desperately, have been paying really high interest rates in order to get it. And at the other end of the spectrum, strong banks, banks that had enough money to start with, have been able to compete more effectively by doing things like promising to make a loan if the borrower agrees to bring all of their deposits to the bank. And so the problem is that banks in the middle, who disproportionately were the recipients of government aid, are struggling to raise deposits even as the level throughout the system rises.
We mentioned Citigroup's announcement that it'll make available $36.5 billion to spark lending. Will that help?
Every little bit helps, I suppose. And, of course, Citigroup has been the single greatest recipient of government aid. This is a company that is under tremendous pressure to show that that money is helping taxpayers And this is an effort to do that.
Do you think that there has been the concern expressed that we will see some bank failures in the near future because it won't be able to continue like this? Do you think that that's something that's a very real possibility?
Absolutely. We had six bank failures in January. That's the most in any month during the current recession. We had three just this Friday. Some of the weakest banks are just going to fail. I don't think there's any question that we're going to see more of that.
Benjamin Applebaum, financial reporter for The Washington Post, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
February 12th, 1809, turned out to be quite a day. Two men, now known by just their last names, were born on that day, Lincoln and Darwin. Abraham Lincoln in Kentucky, Charles Darwin in England. Lincoln, of course, went on to be one of the most well-known American presidents. Darwin developed the theory of evolution, and both men are getting their fair share of attention this month. Today we're going to spend some time reflecting on Charles Darwin with journalist David Quammen. His essay, Darwin's First Clues, appears in the February issue of National Geographic as part of a celebration of Darwin's bicentennial. And David Quammen joins us from the studios of Yellowstone Public Radio in Bozeman, Montana. David, welcome.
Thank you, Deb. It's good to be with you.
In your article, you write that Darwin's story is probably one of the best known, but there are a lot of myths. Why don't we start with the legend and the story itself, if you could simplify it a bit for us and just remind us of Darwin's journey.
Sure. The simplified sort of mythic version is that Darwin was a pious young man who had studied theology at Cambridge and went off on a 5-year voyage around the world on a boat called the Beagle, went to the Galapagos, saw some amazing species of reptiles and birds there, got the idea for evolution by natural selection, Eureka, was traveling as the naturalist on board this ship, came home, wrote a book called The Origin of Species, and changed the world.
So that's it in a nutshell. Let's start with what some of those myths might be now.
What's
wrong here? First of all, probably the fact that he really didn't go on the Beagle as a naturalist. Isn't that right?
That's right, yeah. He was invited to go along essentially as gentleman dining companion to Robert Fitzroy, the captain, this mercurial aristocratic captain in the British Navy who wanted someone to share his cabin for dinner each night, and it wasn't appropriate in the British Navy in those days for the captain to eat with the men. So he found this young fellow, 22-year-old graduate of Cambridge, who really didn't know quite what he was going to do next in his life, and the invitation was made, and Darwin's father first was against it and finally was persuaded to go along with it, and Darwin went off.
And so Darwin really wasn't sort of a scientific expert by any means here.
Well, he was. He was very interested in natural history. He didn't have a great amount of training or experience. He had a bit of training in geology. He was a very avid collector of beetles. He was a devoted amateur natural historian, but he wasn't anything like the disciplined, focused, extremely proficient naturalist that he became in the course of the Beagle Voyage. It was on-the-job training for him, and he grew into the role of ship's naturalist. The actual naturalist quit, and Darwin took over that role, and then he far transcended that role.
And let's first go back to the trip itself. When he went to the Galapagos, where most of us think he did a lot of his groundbreaking work and was able to see some of his theories in real life, it really may not have been the place where Darwin sort of had his eureka moment. Isn't that right?
Well, right. Yeah, the thing to remember about the Galapagos is that he spent only about 3 weeks there, near the very end of the trip. It was essentially a pit stop as they crossed the Pacific, circumnavigating the Earth on the way home. But before that, they had spent most of the voyage up and down the coast of South America. The purpose of the Beagle Voyage was to survey the coasts and the harbors of South America for the British Navy. Darwin would go ashore while the surveying was being done. And years before he got to the Galapagos, he had spent time in Argentina and had discovered a couple of digs of Pleistocene mammal fossils. And this is what I write about in the National Geographic article, the importance of those Pleistocene mammal fossils and some observations he made of living creatures in Argentina in probably triggering his original thinking about the idea that species must have evolved from common ancestors.
But when he found these fossils in Argentina, he didn't know what they were, right?
He didn't know what they were. Most of these were undescribed species, species new to science. One of them was known to science, recently described. It was a giant ground sloth known as Megatherium. So Darwin found some fossils of Megatherium and some other peculiar fossils that he could recognize as being related to living creatures that also inhabited that area. For instance, some scutes of a great shell that looked very much like an armadillo. Some other fossils of things that looked like sloths and represented further species of giant ground sloth. And Darwin started thinking, well, what's the meaning of the fact that these giant forms of extinct mammal were living 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 years ago or more in this area where we now find living species of sloth, of armadillo, etc. And so it was a juxtaposition in time, in the vertical column of time, of species that seemed to be closely similar to one another that made him think that the idea of all species having been created one at a time by God was not the most persuasive and not the most economical explanation.
This sounds like something that actually would take quite a bit of time. And if he came on board the Beagle as sort of an amateur natural historian, and if he found these fossils and it was really difficult to know exactly what they were, what were the qualities, do you think, that Darwin did have at the time that he was then able to develop not only into the true naturalist, but then the person who gave us the theory of evolution and natural selection?
I think of three qualities. First of all, he was in the process of becoming a very, very acute, disciplined observer of natural history facts. He watched closely. He looked closely. He saw things with great precision and care. Secondly, he was good at putting disparate facts and ideas together, drawing something from geology, drawing something from the distribution of living species, drawing something from this book, something from that conversation, putting those together into larger and more meaningful shapes. And the third trait, I think that was very important for him, is that he was extremely honest, intellectually honest. When he came to believe something, he wouldn't flinch from pursuing it or testing the idea, testing it against possibly contrary evidence. So it was this. It was observation, it was synthesis, and it was his blazing intellectual honesty, I think, that made him who he was.
We're speaking with David Quammen, who writes about Charles Darwin in this month's edition of National Geographic. You can link to his article on our website. We'll be back with him in a minute, and we'll talk about the reaction to Darwin's thinking about evolution in the 19th century. And later in the show, what is sexting among teenagers, and when is it considered abuse? You're listening to Here and Now. Before the break, we were talking about Darwin's voyage aboard the HMS Beagle, the trip that triggered his thinking about evolution by natural selection. But David, Darwin's book, The Origin of Species, came out more than 20 years after that trip. What took him so long to put his thinking together?
That's what they call Darwin's delay. He came back from the voyage, got back to England in 1836, started brainstorming. At that point, he suspected that species evolved, but he couldn't have said how. He didn't have an explanatory mechanism. So he spent about 2 years noodling away in some private notebooks that became known as his transmutation notebooks, transmutation being the word that he used before evolution became the word. After about 2 years, he hit on the idea of evolution by natural selection, that particular mechanism involving what is loosely known as the survival of the fittest. So that's 1838, autumn of 1838. He didn't publish The Origin of Species until autumn of 1859. So that's a 21-year delay. What took so long? What was he doing during that whole period of time? Well, he was he was temporizing, he was delaying, he was being hesitant, he was being reluctant because he knew what a firestorm of controversy this idea was going to cause. It was going to be very unpleasant and difficult for his wife, among others, because she was a pious Christian believer, unlike him. And he was also busy with follow-up chores from the Beagle Voyage, with some subjects that he got distracted into, including an 8-year journey through the taxonomy of barnacles. He became the world's leading barnacle taxonomist. And he was, during that whole period of time, also continuing to gather evidence, to refine his arguments, to work very carefully and slowly on his theory of evolution by natural selection. So it was a combination of things: reluctance to publish because of the difficulties that it would bring him, but he was always pushed forward by this blazing intellectual honesty, and he wanted to get it right. He wanted to really put across this idea persuasively, not simply announce it and take credit for having hit upon it first.
Could you tell us what was the reaction to Origin of Species then after it was published?
First of all, it sold out immediately. People wanted to read this book. It was talked about and read widely in England and quickly in around the world, including some bootleg pirated editions in the United States. The reactions to it were divided. Some people said, oh my gosh, that's the answer to the question that we weren't even smart enough to ask. So stupid of us not to have thought of it ourselves. This is amazing. This is wonderful. This reshapes our understanding of life on Earth. Hurrah. And other people reacted very negatively. They thought it was gobbledygook. They thought it was godless materialism. They thought it was outrageous and threatening because it implied that perhaps humans had also arisen by this process. And it's important to know that it wasn't just the church that was reacting negatively to it. Some people think, well, it was Darwin published The Origin of Species and then it was science versus religion. No. You need to understand that science and religion were part of the same British establishment at the point when Darwin published this book. Most of the scientists who had taught him at Cambridge, or many of them anyway, were ordained Anglican clergymen. Most of the people who were doing science in Britain at that point were very deeply invested in Christianity, in the Anglican Church in particular. So it was a combined resistance of conventional scientists and religious people who resisted Darwin's ideas. When his ideas were finally accepted, it was in two phases. First, he persuaded people that evolution had occurred, and then decades later, and people tend to forget this, decades later, they were still fighting, resisting the idea that natural selection could be the mechanism. And that part of the revolution really wasn't fulfilled until the 1930s, after the joining of modern genetics with Darwinian theory.
And how has it held up over time?
Well, it has held up magnificently. It has gotten only more and more strongly confirmed over time as more evidence has appeared through the various different branches of biology, including now recently molecular genetics. We have more and more evidence of common ancestry, of evolution by natural selection. So Darwin, the theory has been elaborated, it's been refined, it's been complicated by additions to it, like the idea of punctuated equilibrium from Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge. But the core of the theory has not only survived, but become more and more solidly established by all these different forms of evidence from all the branches of biology. There's a famous quote from the geneticist Theodosius Dobzhansky 45 years ago. He said, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution." And it's become even more true. Medical research and genetics and molecular biology, all of it revolves around the great Darwinian truth at the core.
Is there a particular passage of Darwin or a piece of Darwin's writing that really stands out for you that you could read to us right now?
Well, I just happen to have a copy of The Origin of Species in front of me, and there's a famous closing sentence. So I'll read that to you.
Okay.
Last sentence of The Origin, or last two sentences. Thus, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of the higher animals, directly follows. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers, having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. That's the only place in the book where a form of the word evolution occurs. It's like a little golden bell that rings at the very end.
Well, David, thanks very much for speaking with us about this.
You're welcome, Deb. It's been my pleasure.
David Quammen's essay, Darwin's First Clues, appears in the February issue of National Geographic. We'll link you to it on our website, here-now.org. Still ahead today, two historians combine forces on a spirited piece of fiction. Back after the news, here and now. Last month, three teenage girls in Pennsylvania were charged with disseminating child pornography for texting nude photos of themselves to their boyfriends. Their boyfriends were then charged with possessing child pornography. In Billerica, Massachusetts, authorities found a nude photo of a 14-year-old girl circulating on middle school students' text messages. Those are just a couple of examples of the legal repercussions of what kids are calling sexting. An estimated 20% of teenagers take part in so-called sexting, which of course raises questions about when certain online behaviors are abuse and when they might lead to violence. The San Francisco-based nonprofit Family Violence Prevention Fund is kicking off what it's calling the That's Not Cool campaign. Here's one of the group's web videos that starts with a few colorful sock puppets representing teens hanging out at the school lunch table talking about their significant others.
My girlfriend texts me every 10 seconds asking me where I am.
My boyfriend keeps pressuring me to send him nude pics.
Sometimes this guy I'm seeing spies on my social network pages.
What should I do?
I'm not sure if it's because she likes me
or because he thinks he can control me.
That's a web video from the That's Not Cool campaign. Nick Law is chief creative officer of the digital advertising agency RGA that helped create the campaign, and he joins us now. Nick, let's talk about digital dating violence. What type of behavior defines it?
The examples of this digital dating violence range from constant texting, so, you know, an overbearing boyfriend texting a girlfriend asking where she is constantly. Sending nude pics, which you mentioned, is something that's much more common than we know. And the last one is spying on social networks. These kids spend so much time on social networks, and, you know, their community exists so much online that, you know, a jealous boyfriend or girlfriend hacking into their partner's account can be sort of revealing.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said constant, the sort of constant communication, which obviously is why technology is attractive to so many of us. When is it a problem?
Well, it's a problem if the person who's contacting you is trying to control you or is being disrespectful. You know, it's especially a problem because this new digital landscape is a little bit like Lord of the Flies for these kids. You know, the parents are living parallel in a parallel universe, and they tend not to be as aware of what's going on. So there isn't really a set of sort of behavioral standards because it's so new and because it is just amongst these kids. So they're trying to figure it out themselves, what's appropriate and what isn't. And this is a time in these kids' lives that they're very impressionable. They want to please, and they want to be a part of the gang. And they certainly don't want to be told by parents that don't belong to this world what to do.
Oh, so that makes it easy.
Yes. Well, I think that's why the campaign encourages these kids to draw their own digital line.
So how do they go about drawing that line?
Well, I think that the first thing is to recognize that you might have uncomfortable feelings about how you're being communicated to. You might feel disrespected, and that there should be an appropriate response. The campaign has a bunch of tactics for kids to use to communicate in a way that doesn't feel righteous, but is very precise. You know, so on the site itself, you can go and there are these call-out cards that they can send to someone who they think is being inappropriate, that is sort of crossing a line. So they say things like, thanks to your texting, I never have to enjoy free space. You know, I'm looking forward to unclogging my inbox this weekend. So they're sharp responses to issues. They have a sense of humor that probably wouldn't enrage but might embarrass the person who's perpetrating it. You know, this is an age when you don't want to, you know, the way you communicate is almost as important as what you're communicating. So the tone is very important. You know, the subject is serious, but the method of getting that subject across is almost disarming.
You know, you mentioned that a lot of kids would be obviously very reluctant to listen to a parent who's completely not keyed into this world and tell them exactly what constitutes appropriate behavior in their digital communications. But the campaign does try to at least get them thinking about what might be appropriate guidelines. And in one particular video, there's some fruit talking, a banana, a pear, and an apple. And they're all hanging out. They're supposed to be boys talking after school. And you know, you can imagine this conversation a little bit. So let's listen.
So I hung out with Orange again yesterday.
Dude, Orange is hot.
Yeah, man. She's juicy. You think you could get her to send some nude pics?
I've already tried. She's not into it.
Text her and see. You never know. Maybe she'll peel something off. Don't be such a coward, man. Do it.
Do it. Do it.
Little peer pressure there, huh?
Yeah, and I think it's more common than we'd like to think. And so, you know, so at the end of each of these videos, there is a sort of multiple choice that you can choose ways to deal with each of these issues.
So the video makes it clear, giving advice to a boy, that he doesn't have to listen to his friends. Probably overarching advice to many kids that when they don't feel comfortable with certain digital behavior, that they should speak up. But what about advice for parents who, as you say, really don't know what's going on and probably don't understand most of this technology that's being used by their kids?
I think the best thing parents can do is sort of the same thing that we're trying to do in the campaign. And that is to make sure that the kids understand that they can say no, that they can decide what's appropriate, what makes them feel comfortable, and to understand that, you know, respectful behavior is important, no matter, you know, what screen, you know, it's on a cell phone or on your computer. I mean, the other thing is that the digital landscape that we live in, it changes with such velocity that it's pretty hard to be prescriptive, because some of these social networks and these digital tools didn't exist, you know, a year or two ago. So, you know, we expect that kids are going to have to think for themselves. So you've got to give them the ability to decide what's appropriate and give them the confidence to communicate that to people.
And I was astonished to read, it's middle school, really, that this is also happening. And
right.
In middle school, obviously, is a time when many of these kids aren't even supposed to be dating.
That's right. Well, I have an 8-year-old daughter. I'm very aware that she has this world that I probably think is a lot more innocent than it is.
Does your 8-year-old have a cell phone?
No, she doesn't. But, you know, I know that it's going to be pretty soon that she'll be asking for one and that her friends will have one. She, you know, she loves going on the computer and just looking around. She doesn't really belong to a social network yet. But as I said, it's so easy to access this stuff. There's just no way to control it. You can't put barriers around it. So I think that on one hand, parents want kids to have these tools so they can, you know, keep in contact with them, but they're the very same tools that give them this sort of endless freedom of extended communities. And, you know, often they're part of these communities a lot before they've really matured socially. And kids have such a fearless and intuitive relationship with technology that unless they understand what's appropriate before they start engaging.
Well, Nick Law, Chief Creative Officer of the agency that created the That's Not Cool campaign, which is kicking off this month. He joined us from his office in New York. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you very much.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. You're listening to Here and Now. Among the casualties of the recession, some of the services offered by the Meals on Wheels program. The nonprofit group provides 1 million meals a day to homebound people over 60. Several state chapters are scaling back. Some are selling their delivery vans to pay for food. A few have had to shut down operations. Sandy Santazzo is executive director of Meals on Wheels of Rhode Island. And Sandy, how is your chapter affected?
The cuts in funding this year have been devastating to the program. We're basically funded by both federal and state funds with a lot of outside fundraising. We have had to cap our meals at $1,700 a day, and as of today, I have 150 people on the waiting list.
How do you determine the extent of need, I guess, is the question.
The federal guidelines is basically that they're over 60 years of age, and also that they're homebound. They cannot drive, they cannot shop, they cannot stand at a stove to cook, and they have no family. They completely live alone. That is where our priority is today. I have over, 14 people on this program, believe it or not, still living in their own home, over 100 years old. So, the average age of a client is 85, and you're pretty much looking at very frail people at this point.
Huh. So it's not based on income, then?
No, we don't even ask income.
You've basically been talking about your clients, really, and how they are affected. What about your operations? What about your staff and your volunteers?
We have about 1,100 volunteers, and I call our volunteers the windows to the world to our program. They are wonderful people. I have some people that have actually been volunteering over 30 years. Rain, wind, snow, sleet, they are out there. As far as staff, every single one of my departments had to lose somebody. It ended up being 9 people that particular day that we had to notify those people, not to take away from 911, but that was my 122, January 22nd, when we had to notify the people, and we brought them all in a group, and it was a very, very emotional day. I don't think I will ever forget it. So we really are on a skeleton crew.
So it's 9 people out of a staff of 48. You know, you also mentioned that some of your clients are over 100. We're talking about very frail people. Can you share with us a story, a personal story of someone who was expecting to receive your service and is now on a wait list?
Well, to me, one of the most unfortunate things that could happen is that the person that is living home alone becomes malnutritious. And that's because they're not eating the proper food, or they're eating out of a cereal box, or they're eating crackers, and they inevitably end up in a nursing home. And it's just so unnecessary to put somebody in a nursing home where they really don't want to be, where there's no reason why they can't stay in their own home and around their own memories, and simply just because of nutrition. The other part of that is that 85-year-old people, in many, many cases, have no family. And that daily social contact with that volunteer coming in, they've made friends. It's a, hi, how are you? Maybe they take the mail out on their way out or whatever. But it's that safety check, and they know there's somebody out there that cares about them.
Are you hopeful that with the new administration in Washington or perhaps with media attention to this problem, that you may be able to improve your situation financially?
I'm always hoping, because as far as I'm concerned, to put somebody in a nursing home and have them go through all of their assets to only end up on Medicaid in a nursing home is going to cost the state a lot more money than it's going to cost if they just gave us the money to keep the person at home, healthy and fed, watched over on a daily basis. So the more people, as far as I'm concerned, the more people that we can put on the program, the better off everybody is.
Sandy Santazzo, Executive Director of Meals on Wheels of Rhode Island, thanks very much for being with us and good luck.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, 2 history professors pen a story of passion and politics set in colonial Boston. Back in 1 minute, here and now. Did they make it up? Well, sort of. In their novel, Blind Spot, historians and old friends Jill Lepore and Jane Kamensky combine their academic chops with the freedom of fiction to paint a vivid picture of early Boston, complete with a very sexy romance. The New York Times calls it an erudite and entertaining recreation of colonial America on the brink of the revolution. The full title of the book is Blind Spot, by a lady in disguise and a gentleman in exile. And Here and Now's Alex Ashlock met the co-authors on Boston's Long Wharf.
This is where Blind Spot begins and ends, so it seemed like a natural place to meet these history professors turned novelists for a conversation and a tour of some of the prominent scenes in the book. Jane Kamensky teaches at Brandeis, Jill Lepore at Harvard. They started this as a serious project, a small gift for a mentor, but they had so much fun it grew into a big novel, 500 pages in all, in the tradition of Tom Jones. They took turns writing chapters, which take the form of letters written by the main characters. Kaminsky's are from The Lady in Disguise, addressed to her best friend. Lepore's from The Gentleman in Exile, addressed to the reader. That gentleman is a portrait painter named Stuart Jameson, Jamie to his friends. He arrives in Boston horribly seasick, along with his slobbering dog Gulliver, in 1764, having fled creditors in his native Scotland.
And when Jameson arrived here and looked out at the city, he would have seen a city that looked like a town by any kind of Scottish standards, by Edinburgh standards, a town moving up on a hill. But what we can see here, if you're standing looking directly into the city, the structure that would have jumped out from Jameson's point of view and jumps out to everybody even as they're nearing shore is what we call the old state house, was called the townhouse in the 18th century before the revolution. It was built in 1713 and was one of the larger and more dominant structures in the city. And you can see how dwarfed it is here by every other building, these skyscrapers of the kind of downtown financial district.
He had obviously been in big towns. He'd been in London. Was he impressed by what he saw here? What did he think of what he saw here?
What he thinks about Boston is much based on, again, what contemporary travelers from Europe thought about Boston when they visited around this period, was that it had a kind of oversized ambition. You know, the town, you know, it is Winthrop City on a hill, founded in 1630. It has this lofty and quite pious set of ambitions about being a model for all the world, to see a beacon unto the world. And it's kind of a backwater. And it's also, in the 1760s, devastated financially. So shops were closed everywhere. I mean, the city was deep in a terrible recession as in the consequence of the French and Indian War.
Did you have something to add to that, Jane?
He's not overly awed by London. So he, as we fill in his backstory, you learn that he has begun to climb the rungs of the painter's ladder in 18th century London, and he leaves. He doesn't like the sort of social climbing, glittery atmosphere of the metropolis. So one of the things that happens to him in the course of the story is he becomes more contented in a backwater, what would have been a backwater to him with his cosmopolitan background, than his counterpart, Fanny Easton, who is born to Boston and can only look out. You know, he's sort of looking in and winds up being quite charmed by what he sees facing west. And she's all about facing east with longing and wondering what it would be like to get out of this place that's 2 miles long and less than a mile wide.
That's Jane Kamensky, dropping a hint, perhaps, of how Blind Spot ends. Her Fanny Easton is a talented painter in her own right, determined to turn her talent into liberty. But she's cast into disgrace after being seduced by her painting master in the home of her prominent father.
And she bore a child, and rather than do what her father wanted her to do, which was become a governess or marry the seducer, she fled and winds up, after a stint working in the manufactory house with other impoverished Bostonians, passing herself off as a boy to gain a spot as Jameson's apprentice. So that's how they meet, is she presents her sketches to him, sketches she's made in rough charcoal on the bits of paper that she can purloin in the manufactory house.
Of those sketches, Jameson raves. He writes, "Sweet Jesus, surpassing work. Astonished reader, who could have thought, in this town on the edge of the world, to find such raw genius?" Jamie clearly sees Fanny's talent, but he can't see through her disguise. Fanny is so busy trying to maintain that disguise, she can't see Jamie falling in love with her. The authors were in the same boat because they were writing about their characters independently. They weren't even sure Fanny and Jamie would overcome those blind spots. So as part of the finding out process, Lepore and Kaminsky spent time in a home from the era. It's called the Pierce Hitchborn House. It's one of the earliest brick structures in Boston.
Blind Spot is a love story, and I think at the time we came here, we were very much in the what's going to happen next part of the love story. So I think, you know, the smallness of the house at that particular moment in the storytelling, where, as you know, we mentioned before, we had no idea what was going to happen. Were they really going to get together? Were they not? And so there was this kind of a different kind of edge to that.
I mean, a house of this scale, it's like being marooned on a ship. I mean, it's a small space, especially the passageways. Like, the you know, they didn't design their houses for flow. They designed their houses to hold heat in a fuel-scarce environment.
In time, as you might have guessed, Fanny and Jamie generate their own heat. But they also get involved in solving an elaborate political murder mystery involving Boston slaves and Fanny's father. But in the end, this is a romance, and it builds to a final scene inside the tiny room high atop the old state house.
You caught your breath? Okay. So isn't this the most beautiful place in all of Boston?
I can't imagine what it would be like without all the buildings.
You'd be looking at crow's nests and steeples from up here, and but there was nothing of economic significance in the city that you couldn't see from this spot.
What happens in the novel in this tiny little room is something that where you could see everything but be unseen. And that's what I find so magical about being up here. And you really can, from this very tiny place, picture the whole of the city. And we talked about when we started the tour how the journey of the novel for Jameson's character is about feeling that he's kind of been washed ashore in this backwater, this kind of prim, provincial, and pious place. And over the course of the novel, he falls in love with Boston and falls in love with what it is to be in the rebellious provinces, looking back toward England and imagining a different kind of politics and imagining a world without arbitrary rule. And that's part of the passion that the novel is about, that's supposed to be part of what's captured in this room.
And Fanny and Stuart see that future from here.
Although they see it looking in somewhat different directions. So she still has this powerful yearning for what she can only imagine from across the sea. It's his special location, having come from the metropolitan center, to prize the bumptious provincialism of this place in a way that still at the end of the novel feels confining and not redemptive to her.
So at this point, you might be asking, do Fanny and Jamie end up together, happily ever after, as the colonies hurtle toward the American Revolution? All I can say, dear listener, is this. A painter must paint.
Here and Now's Alex Ashlock prepared our report on Blind Spot by historians and first-time novelists Jane Kaminsky and Jill Lepore. By the way, for listeners in the Boston area, they'll be reading from the book at Harvard's Charles Warren Center tomorrow afternoon. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.